KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Trump administration, saying lower courts went too far in issuing nationwide injunctions. It's a big case. We'll hear from Carrie Johnson and Nina Totenberg on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Immigration agents grabbed a landscaper, pinned him down, and punched him as someone took video. The man is the father of three United States Marines. One of his sons talks with NPR this hour. Also, doctors respond to a decision by a vaccine advisory committee. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. fired the panel, then named new members who began re-examining vaccines. And Rachel Martin throws Michelle Obama a wild card asking about her ambitions. It's Friday, June 27th. Fashion designer Vera Wang is 76. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The U.S. Supreme Court has handed President Trump a major victory in his effort to end birthright citizenship. In a 6-3 decision, the justices ruled that the federal courts lack broad authority to grant nationwide injunctions, but did not weigh in on the constitutional merits of Trump's executive order to end birthright citizenship. Amanda Frost, a legal scholar at the University of Virginia, spoke to NPR shortly after the ruling was handed down this morning.
As a result of this decision, now while individual plaintiffs could win relief, each and every person affected would have to sue in order to get relief. And in other words, an administration that's violating the law could lose a case and yet nonetheless apply the policy across the nation.
Trump's executive order on birthright citizenship aims to deny citizenship to U.S.-born children of people living in the country without legal status. In a separate case, the Supreme Court upheld the provision of the Affordable Care Act that provided free preventive care for millions of Americans. The vote was 6-3, with Chief Justice John Roberts and Justices Amy Coney Barrett and Brett Kavanaugh joining the court's three liberals in the majority. The Chancellor of Germany says the European Union should do a, quote, quick and simple trade deal with the U.S. rather than a slow and complicated one. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
Speaking at a summit of EU leaders in Brussels, where European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen unveiled the latest U.S. proposals, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz said the clock is ticking, businesses are in danger, and there's no time to negotiate a sophisticated new trade agreement. European industries, chemicals, pharmaceuticals, cars, agricultural products, and wine are already being burdened with 10% tariffs. They could go higher if no agreement is reached with the Trump administration. The EU is also on the cusp of signing a major trade accord with Latin America's Mercosur bloc. France has opposed that deal, but may be ready to compromise given the free trade problems with the U.S. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
The Pentagon has announced that the U.S. Navy is changing the name of one of its ships. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says the USNS Harvey Milk will be renamed the Oscar B. Peterson. He says the decision was made to take the politics out of ship naming.
We're not renaming the ship to anything political. This is not about political activists, unlike the previous administration. Instead, we're renaming the ship after a United States Navy Congressional Medal of Honor recipient.
Harvey Milk was a pioneering gay rights activist. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 310 points. This is NPR News. Nike is reporting a sharp drop in quarterly earnings. The athletic apparel and equipment company says earnings fell 68% as sales declined 12%. NPR's Alina Selyuk reports.
Nike's in the middle of a consequential turnaround. The athletic giant has been losing sales for a long time now, thanks to repetitive sneaker designs and costly missteps trying to hold some of its shoes back from retail stores. Last year, Nike replaced its CEO with a company veteran called out of retirement, and he's now saying there's, quote, a clear path to recovery ahead. For now, Nike is losing money as it offloads its old inventory, jumpstarts fresher designs, and spends big on marketing. But it's mended its deals with Dick's Sporting Goods, Foot Locker, and Amazon, and it's predicting that the current quarter will see a decline in sales that's a lot smaller than before, which sent Nike's share price up. Alina Seluch, NPR News.
NASA says that a mysterious fireball that was spotted across several southern states on Thursday was a meteor. The agency says that it entered Earth's atmosphere, streaking across the skies at least 30,000 miles an hour before exploding over Georgia. The flash and loud boom were reported in at least six states, including Alabama, the Carolinas, and parts of Florida. Experts are looking for fragments now and are hoping to learn more about where it came from. Stocks are trading higher on Wall Street, the Dow up 305 points, the Nasdaq Composite up 125, the S&P up 35 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Columbia Records with Barbra Streisand's new album, The Secret of Life, Partners, Volume 2. Featuring 11 duets with Paul McCartney, Ariana Grande, Bob Dylan, James Taylor, Hozier, and others. Available where music is sold. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The Trump administration has revealed a number of new details about U.S. airstrikes on Iran's nuclear program.
The president's top military advisor described an operation many years in the making. And at the end of those years, he said, B-2 pilots put giant bombs on the target and returned safely. At the same briefing, the defense secretary attacked the media, but officials did not give much clarity on exactly how much damage the attack did to Iran's nuclear program.
For more, we're joined by NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Greg, so are we any closer at all to knowing how much damage was done to Iran's nuclear program?
Well, we're learning more, but we still don't have a clear assessment. And it's probably not realistic to expect one at this point. All the evidence presented by the Trump administration shows the U.S. airstrikes hit their target Sunday at three separate nuclear sites south of Iran's capital, Tehran. But President Trump just got way out ahead of everyone by immediately saying the Iranian program was completely wiped out. There just doesn't appear to be enough intelligence yet to make such a definitive statement. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, and CIA Director John Ratcliffe briefed senators on Capitol Hill Thursday. A number of senators emerged and said it's just too early to tell the full extent of the damage.
And there was also that Pentagon briefing that Steve mentioned earlier, Greg, where we heard about how long the U.S. Has been tracking developments at the most important nuclear site, Fordos. Tell us about the briefing.
Yeah, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dan Kane, said the U.S. detected Iran's work on the mountain in Fordo early on. So way back in 2009, the military selected a couple officers with the Pentagon's Defense Threat Reduction Agency to work on this full time.
For more than 15 years, this officer and his teammate lived and breathed this single target, Fordo. He watched the Iranians dig it out. He watched the construction, the weather, the discard material, the geology, every nook, every crater. They literally dreamed about this target at night when they slept.
And this was extremely sensitive and secretive work. They couldn't discuss it with family or friends. They just kept grinding away all these years with all the twists and turns involving Iran's nuclear program.
So what problems do they see?
Well, they came to realize the U.S. didn't have a weapon that could reach a target this deep inside a mountain, perhaps 300 feet down. So Kane said they collaborated with munitions experts, and the result was this 30,000-pound bunker-busting bomb known as the Massive Ordnance Penetrator.
They tested it over and over again. They accomplished hundreds of test shots and dropped many full-scale weapons against extremely realistic targets for a single purpose: kill this target at the time and place of our nation's choosing.
And that time and place came Sunday in Iran.
Okay, so it seems like information is trickling in. What are we learning, though?
Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, said his country's nuclear facility suffered serious damage, but he didn't provide details. And Rafael Grossi, the head of the UN's nuclear watchdog agency, the International Atomic Energy Agency, also said he believes there was significant damage, but he doesn't think the entire nuclear program was destroyed. Now, a big question is the whereabouts of 900 pounds of highly enriched uranium. Did Iran hide that somewhere before the U.S. attacks? Well, Grossi said Iranian officials told him they did take protective measures for that uranium, which could be used for a bomb eventually.
All right, that's NPR's Greg Myrie. Greg, thank you.
Sure thing, eh?
Okay, Greg mentioned a briefing for senators. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia was in it. He is on the Senate committees that oversee the military and foreign relations, and he's with us once again. Senator, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What impression did you come away with about the level of damage to Iran's nuclear program?
Steve, it was entirely a classified hearing, and so obviously I'm not going to talk about classified information, but I think if you look at the combined public statements that these officials have made, that the Iranian foreign minister has made, that the IAEA has made, and that Israel has made, the bottom line conclusion is severe and significant damage to Iranian's nuclear program, with details still coming out. But severe and significant damage would be the fair way to characterize this.
I appreciate that. And that doesn't seem inconsistent with the Defense Intelligence Agency report that NPR has reported on and others have reported on. That said, with low confidence, as they put it, that the military hit Fordo, that they did some damage, but that the Iranians might have moved uranium elsewhere just in time. Is that report that the White House has criticized, in fact, a decent bottom line for what the government knows at this point?
Steve, again, that report is classified. I read it in a classified setting, and I don't really want to talk about it, but let me just put it in this kind of a context. If the president on Saturday night had said, "We have taken this action and we've caused severe and significant damage to the Iranian nuclear program," you wouldn't have seen all this damage control over the damage for the last few days. The president overstated it in all likelihood. He compared it to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He put up an insulting and juvenile musical video on his Truth Social account with a bomb, 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 bomb Iran song. And now you've had the Pentagon try to scramble to assuage his ego, yelling at reporters. They had to postpone the briefing that they gave the senators from Tuesday to Thursday. They had to disinvite Tulsi Gabbard from coming because apparently they didn't like what she might have said. They're scrambling because the president has kind of dislocated his own shoulder by patting himself on the back in some ways that are unrealistic. And that segues into the concern that I have. We shouldn't be going to war on the say-so of one person. That's not how the nation goes to war. General Kaine talks about, we will do this at the time and place of the nation's choosing. Mm-hmm. The nation didn't choose that. President Trump made a unilateral decision without notifying, consulting, or getting approval from Congress. In my view, that is just flat wrong. And that's why I filed a war powers resolution to get senators to weigh in on the question of, should the nation be at war with Iran without a vote of Congress? I don't think we should. Some might think we should. We will have that vote later today.
Is the point moot because the president says the operation's over anyway?
Well, if you completely believe that when he says that, there is no chance of any more military action against Iran, then yes, but I don't think anybody believes that. The president used military action to strike Iran in his first term. He's just expended tremendous, U.S. assets. These massive ordnance penetrators and the Tomahawk missiles are expensive. They take a long time to reconstitute. I don't think anyone should have confidence that the president will not use military action in the future.
You're raising an important point here, Senator, about who in our republic gets to decide if we go to war or commit an act of war. There's a lot we could discuss about that. I want to ask first, though, about the substance. You're criticizing the way the president committed this act of war. But it is a situation where Iran had a nuclear program. It was of grave concern to multiple U.S. administrations and both political parties. And then this situation comes up where Israel had started a war. What would you have done differently if you were the president? What would you have done differently given that Israel had started the war against Iran? Iran does have this nuclear program, and the U.S. did have the available bomb for Fordo, which seems to have been developed just for that purpose.
Steve, there's two things I would have done differently. First, this war really is sort of on Trump's shoulders because he tore up a nuclear deal that was working, that was limiting Iran's nuclear program even more than these bombs have limited it. This was a program that was working not only in the eyes of our allies and the IAEA, but also working in the eyes of Trump's term one cabinet national security team that said, don't tear up this deal. It's limiting Iranian centrifuges, limiting enrichment, limiting nuclear research. We had deep inspections into what Iran was doing, but when President Trump tore that up, Iran raced forward. So number one, preferred diplomacy over bombs. And number two, if Israel wants to start a war with Iran, we will help defend Israel, but we didn't need to join this war. And the Israelis had achieved significant goals against the nuclear program. In fact, the day before President Trump launched these missiles and these bombs, Israel said it had already set the Iranian program back 2 or 3 years. There was no urgency to this. There was nothing that meant the president needed to act without consulting Congress. So I think we shouldn't be at war without Congress, but I also know deeply Virginians, my troops, I'm on the Armed Services Committee, they think being involved in a third war in the Middle East since 2001 is absolutely ridiculous and would suggest that the U.S. hadn't learned the lessons of the past 20 years.
Another quick question about the president and Congress. The White House claims it's going to limit classified information given to Congress from now on because somebody disclosed DIA findings, Defense Intelligence Agency findings that we mentioned earlier that the president didn't like. Did this subject come up in your meeting?
The subject came up only in this way. A member of the Senate asked, are you going to, curtail information to us? And the administration briefers said, no, we are not. But we're still worried about it because the president chose to notify Republican leaders of the strike, but not Democratic leaders. And that is something that no president has done during the time that I've been here. I've been with Democratic and Republican presidents. There's a protocol about who gets noticed. And it's both the Democratic and Republican leaders of the key committees, Armed Services, Foreign Relations, Intelligence, Appropriations.
Are your Republican colleagues sticking up for you and saying national security needs to be bipartisan? It really matters.
I've not heard them. I hope they will. And I think they believe that it should, but I've not heard anybody raise concerns about Democrats not getting information.
Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, it's always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you, sir.
Steve, great to be with you. Thanks.
NPR invited multiple Republican senators on the program to discuss this intelligence. We're happy to hear them on another day. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember war correspondent Rod Nordland. He was diagnosed with a lethal brain tumor in 2019 and died on Sunday at the age of 75. He talked about facing mortality as a war correspondent and as a patient. And we'll hear from legendary guitarist Buddy Guy, who has a cameo in Ryan Coogler's film Sinners. Join us.
I don't know why in the hell I'm here.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of EdUtopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org. From Made in Cookware, Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. The United States Supreme Court last hour issued an opinion limiting the power of federal courts to issue nationwide injunctions. It's a 6-3 decision which fell along ideological lines, and the majority sided with the Trump administration in what had been one of the most highly anticipated cases of this year. At issue here was how lower courts should handle President Trump's executive order on birthright citizenship. We should note that the court seems not directly to have ruled on that at all, but did rule on a challenge to a nationwide injunction by a district court judge, which blocked the Trump administration from unilaterally limiting birthright citizenship. NPR's Kerry Johnson is with us now in studios. In a moment, we'll hear from NPR's Nina Totenberg, who was at the Supreme Court, and we'll begin with Kerry. Kerry, what's the significance of this ruling?
You know, President Trump has already on social media called this a giant win for him, and it's hard to disagree. This conservative supermajority led by Justice Amy Coney Barrett found these so-called universal injunctions likely exceed the power that Congress has given federal courts. And because Trump has used so much executive action, including executive orders, to advance his agenda in immigration and remaking the federal workforce and so many other things, this decision by the court could make it harder for lower court judges to act as a check on Trump's use of executive power in that
way. Let's talk about a little bit of the context here. As I recall, justices during oral arguments and lawyers during oral arguments pointed out that administrations from both political parties have had trouble with judges in the past in this way.
Absolutely. Obama administration, Biden administration folks, as well as Trump administration folks, have been bedeviled by this idea that a single judge somewhere in the country could put a block on an administration policy nationwide. And now this Supreme Court majority seems to have made that a lot harder to do.
Okay, let's bring in now NPR's Nina Totenberg, who's been reading the decision at the U.S. Supreme Court. Nina, welcome. We, of course, have heard some of the basics from Kerry and through the morning with our live coverage, but as you read the decision, what stands out to you?
What stands out to me is that for a second year in a row, the Supreme Court of the United States has given all presidents, at the moment President Trump, enormous protection to do what he wants. Last year it was, for all practical purposes, immunity from prosecution even after leaving office. And this year, this president, who has issued so many executive orders, far more than anybody else, there is language in this opinion that defers to those executive orders until cases are litigated and individual plaintiffs or individual organizations can get redress that they want to get.
I want to bring in Kerry Johnson just very briefly, and then we'll finish out with Nina. But when we talk about individual plaintiffs, Kerry, how is that different from what was happening yesterday or a few months ago in the matter of birthright citizenship?
Well, in a lot of cases, people whose immigration status was being contested or who were being disadvantaged in some way by these executive orders could rely on an individual judge to block a policy from taking effect all over the country universally. And now, as a result of this Supreme Court decision today by this conservative supermajority, it will, in essence, require people to go to court one by one in order to get that same relief. The exception is with respect to states, because birthright issues and the birth of children is such an important process, and it involves a lot of state power and state action. It's possible the states could still get some relief for themselves.
Nina Totenberg, what are the likely effects of this change of the rules, or not change of the rules, the court perhaps would say clarification of them?
Well, as Justice Sotomayor said in her dissent, if there ever was a case in which you needed a nationwide injunction, it would be a case involving birthright citizenship. Because if babies born in the United States don't have automatic birthright citizenship while this case is litigated, and only the individuals and groups that brought the case have that benefit, the president, at least for a time, as much as 6 months or more, can enforce his executive order that says when you're born in the United States and your parents aren't here legally, you do not get birthright citizenship. And he can say, as he did in his executive order, if you're born in the United States and your parents are here legally, but on a temporary, for example, work visa, you do not get automatic citizenship. So this is going to be a huge conundrum. The court does leave open the possibility that all over the country they could start assembling class actions and try to protect people that way, and that states can get into the act. But you're talking about quite a cauldron of legal stuff going on. Justice Sotomayor wrote, the president's mandate to exercise his executive power in any event does not permit him, this is her dissent, to rewrite the Constitution or statutory provisions at a whim by forging ahead and granting relief to the government. And anyway, this court endorses the radical proposition that the president is harmed irreparably when he cannot do something that he wants to do, even if what he wants to do is to break the law.
NPR's Nina Totenberg, thanks so much. And Kerry Johnson, thanks to you for your coverage throughout this morning. And I want to mention that President Trump is expected to speak live in the next few minutes at the White House, and we will have live special coverage of that. So stick with us throughout the morning here on Morning Edition and with NPR News. This is NPR News.
Steve Aoki has been making electronic music for decades, dominating a genre whose popularity has ebbed and flowed. Well, now when dance music is peaking again, Aoki is sticking to his roots.
I am one of the few people in the EDM space that care about dropping albums.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Steve Aoki's latest studio album on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. In an anticipated opinion on birthright citizenship, the U.S. Supreme Court gave the Trump administration more room to press its case to ban recognition of the citizenship of children born in the United States without at least one parent who's an American citizen or a lawful permanent resident. Lower courts have blocked President Trump's executive order. In a 6-3 opinion, the justices said lower courts went too far. NPR's Carrie Johnson explains.
When Congress is not doing very much, presidents are forced, in their view, to take executive actions to accomplish some of their policy agenda. And this practice of nationwide injunctions has allowed people to challenge some of those presidential actions and allowed courts to block them, at least temporarily.
The justices did not rule per se on the constitutional merits of birthright citizenship. On this final day of its term, the Supreme Court also upheld the provision of the Affordable Care Act that provided free preventive care for millions of Americans. The vote was 6-3 with Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Amy Coney Barrett and Brett Kavanaugh joining the court's three liberals in the majority. In another case, the conservatives on the court said parents have a First Amendment right to opt their children out of public school classes that use books with gay characters. Wall Street, the Dow is up 384 points. This is NPR News. A senior official in Kenya's government says the deadly protests witnessed across the East African nation earlier this week were meant to orchestrate a coup. Michael Koloki has more.
Kipchumba Murkomen, the country's interior minister, accused those who took part in the protests of attempting to overthrow the Kenyan government. The protests witnessed in cities and towns across the country were meant to mark the one-year anniversary of deadly demonstrations that took place in the country against a tax bill that had been introduced by the government. Murkomen claimed that on Wednesday this week, police had been forced to hold back large groups of protesters who had tried to approach President William Ruto's official residence, as well as the country's parliament buildings. Several people were killed during the protests, while many others were injured. Tension was reported in a number of regions on Thursday and Friday, including the capital, Nairobi. For NPR News, I'm Michael Kaluki in Nairobi.
Congressional Republicans say they are removing the so-called revenge tax provision from the president's big bill. This at the request of Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent. It would have allowed the government to tax companies with foreign owners, as well as investors from countries considered to be charging unfair foreign taxes to U.S. companies. The concern was that the provision would discourage foreign business investment in the United States. I'm Louise Schiavone. NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The viral and violent arrest of a man in Southern California is raising concerns about the tactics used by Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents during workplace raids. Videos posted online show Narciso Barranco fleeing masked federal agents who then pin him to the ground and strike him multiple times. I spoke with Alejandro Barranco, Narciso's son. Alejandro is a U.S. Marine Corps veteran, and his two brothers are active duty Marines. He told me what it was like to watch the video of his father's arrest.
I think it was completely unprofessional and uncalled for, like beating a man on the ground, punching him repeatedly in the face. I don't think it represents what our law enforcement officers or anything like that. I was really, really mad when I saw that. I couldn't believe it. The way they treated him, like, so inhumane. I threw my phone on the ground. I couldn't watch it.
Now, the Department of Homeland Security has said on social media that your father, quote, assaulted federal law enforcement with a weed whacker. Mm-hmm. And then Customs and Border Protection posted on X a video of what looks like a person swinging a weed whacker at agents. What do you make of that characterization? Does that sound like something your father would do?
No, of course not. And the movement you see from the weed whacker, I think it's a natural instinct because he had sprayed seconds before that. I think it was just his own body, his own instincts just reacting to that spray.
He was sprayed with what?
I'm not sure what it was, mace, pepper spray, I don't know.
How's he doing? Has he been able to process everything that's happened?
I don't think so. I mean, when he called this morning, he was scared. He said that they were moving him. He didn't know why. I mean, all of this is new to him, obviously. It's just, can only imagine how he feels right now.
How long has your father been in the United States?
Since the 90s. I want to say at least 30 years.
Yeah. Well, what would you say to someone that says, hey, if you've been in this country decades, you should have found the time to make sure that something like this eventually wouldn't happen?
Yeah, no, I understand that people might think that way, but they also need to understand that everybody's situation is different. My dad worked Monday to Sunday. He was always trying to provide for us, make sure we were all well-fed, well-dressed, provide a roof over our heads. So, I mean, it's clear that his priorities were us so that we can also give back to this country in this way, the way we serve.
Did you have any conversations with him or maybe other members of your family about what was happening in the LA area with ICE and the possibility maybe that your father might be arrested somehow?
We knew these things were happening, these raids were going on. We prepared them. We told them, you know, keep calm, let them identify themselves, don't say anything, don't sign anything, don't fight back. He knew these things were happening and he accepted the fact that it could happen. But what we weren't prepared for and didn't prep him about was these guys attacking him. We never expected anything like that. We expected these guys to act professionally and up to standards on the United States government.
So considering your brothers are active duty Marines, if they are deployed somehow, somewhere in the world to fight for the United States of America, have you figured out how you might square those feelings of putting life on the line for a country that has done this to a family member?
They know their orders. They know they're supposed to follow orders. And it's, you know, when you're in a situation like that, I do believe you're fighting for those people next to you, not necessarily the country.
What do you think about the Trump administration's approach to people without legal status in the U.S. generally?
I'm not sure they have the right picture because the administration, I believe, I'm not too involved in politics, but I believe they said that they were going after criminals. And from what we've seen, I think it's the complete opposite. I think the majority of people that they're getting are hardworking people who have been here for decades, providing for their family, providing for this country.
Any idea about what comes next for your father?
First and foremost, we want to get him out of there. After that, we'll work on his legal status. But for now, we do want him home.
That's Alejandro Barranco, whose father, Narciso Barranco, was recently detained by ICE. Alejandro, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Yeah, of course, thank you.
NPR reached out to ICE and the Department of Homeland Security. In a statement, DHS Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs Tricia McLaughlin said that on June 21st, Border Patrol agents arrested a man without legal status who, quote, tried to evade law enforcement and refused to comply every step of the way. She said agents took appropriate action and used minimal force to resolve the situation. McLaughlin added that resisting arrest places those being arrested as well as agents and the community at risk.
The jury in the trial of Sean Combs has heard the final arguments from the prosecution. For several hours, federal prosecutors wove together 7 weeks of evidence and testimony. They hope to prove that Combs is guilty of crimes including sex trafficking and racketeering, all of which he denies. We should advise you, as always, this story contains mentions of violence and alleged sex trafficking. No other way to cover this story. Here's NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento.
Much of the government's case against Sean Combs revolves around the testimony of two of his ex-girlfriends, the singer Cassie Ventura and a woman who testified using the pseudonym Jane. Both women say that for years, Combs pressured them to participate in drug-fueled sexual encounters with male escorts that could last multiple days. Ventura and Jane testified that he used financial control, emotional manipulation, and physical force to get them to comply with what he asked, even when he knew they didn't want to. Both women said that early in their relationship, they agreed to these encounters because they loved Combs and wanted to make him happy. But eventually, they told him they did not want to keep having sex with other men. During closing arguments, prosecutor Christy Slavik detailed multiple specific incidents that she said proved Combs trafficked these women. But in order to convict him of trafficking, she explained, the jury only needs to believe Combs forced or coerced each woman into just one of these encounters. The other major charge is for racketeering conspiracy. That's best known as a mob charge, and Slavik argued that Combs did, in fact, run a criminal enterprise, a close circle of employees doing his bidding. Through text messages and phone records, Slavik tried to prove that some of Combs' employees, including assistants and security guards, were deeply involved in crimes committed on his behalf. They include things like bribery, witness tampering, and distributing drugs. Slavik explained to the jury that if they found Combs and his employees committed at least two of these criminal acts, that amounts to racketeering. She told the jury that Combs, quote, used violence, power, and fear to get what he wanted. She told them now it's time to hold him accountable. Today, Combs' defense will make their case before the jury begins deliberations. Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Before you toss that old tomato, consider using it to grow a new one. A gardener has advice on growing your own groceries next time on Here and Now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule. But with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them, in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Lalo Schifrin has died at 93, the composer who accepted this musical mission. He scored hundreds of shows and films like Cool Hand Luke and Bullet. And all his life, one thing led to another. He grew up in Argentina, then came to America while working with the trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie. He wrote the Mission Impossible theme that we're hearing now. Bruce Lee practiced martial arts to this very song and then asked Schifrin to score his final film. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. An HIV/AIDS treatment program created by President George W. Bush is under threat as Republicans in Congress look to cut federal spending. Our colleague Darian Woods from the Indicator podcast examines the legacy of PEPFAR and what it would mean for the program to end.
Not everyone remembers this acutely, but in the 1990s, AIDS was one of the leading causes of death, including in the US. And then came game-changing drugs to treat HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. These drugs were what's called antiretroviral therapy. John Cohen is a senior correspondent for Science magazine and has been covering public health for over 30 years.
They could basically allow people who had HIV to live normal lifespans.
Antiretroviral therapy saved millions of lives in wealthy countries.
Well, that wasn't available to most people living with HIV in the world because the drugs were so incredibly expensive, about $15,000 a year per person.
That's what impelled George W. Bush to start PEPFAR. And what's made PEPFAR successful is that the program is heavily monitored for its outcomes. Program managers can look at a country and see where it's succeeding, where it's failing, and what could be changed. And even some of the countries hardest hit by AIDS have reached these targets.
To date, the program has spent over $120 billion and has saved an estimated 26 million lives. It's a phenomenally successful program.
That success is now under grave threat. The hope had been that American assistance could start phasing down around 2030. But some Republican lawmakers didn't like that some money was targeting higher-risk groups like sex workers and LGBT people. So that glide path has now turned more into a crash landing. Earlier this year, many HIV/AIDS organizations in places like Africa received emails terminating their contracts with the USAID. The emails were signed off, God Bless America. White House Budget Director Russ Voigt said the U.S. is in $37 trillion in debt, and at some point the continent of Africa needs to absorb more of the burden of providing this health care. So could African countries fund HIV/AIDS treatment and prevention themselves?
Sure, and they want to, and they're moving toward that. But to think that this is going to solve our debt problem, I mean, come on, do the math. It's more than simply soft diplomacy. It's creating a stable world where you don't have military conflicts, you don't have countries falling apart because of health.
We reached out to the Department of State asking if its leadership was concerned. A spokesperson said PEPFAR continues to support life-saving HIV testing, care, and treatment approved by the Secretary of State. But they also said that other PEPFAR-funded services are currently being reviewed for efficiency and consistency with U.S. foreign policy. John says, like any large system, there were always wrinkles, like leadership in Washington pushing too hard for those metrics sometimes, or debates over abstinence promotion. But overall, he says, this was an extremely well-run program. In its hobbled state now, though, researchers from the HIV Modeling Consortium estimated 70,000 people have already died. Darian Woods, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. A committee that helps craft vaccine policy in the U.S. has become a source of controversy under the leadership of Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Yesterday, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices wrapped up its two-day meeting. Here's NPR's Will Stone.
This meeting of advisors to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention was unusually high profile, largely because of Secretary Kennedy's decision to purge the entire panel of experts just a few weeks ago. In their place, his handpicked roster of seven members, some with a history of making inaccurate claims about the safety of COVID vaccines. The chair of the committee, Martin Kulldorff, an epidemiologist who's worked on vaccines, began the meeting with a call to rebuild public trust and an announcement that a new working group would re-examine the childhood vaccine schedule.
The number of vaccines that our children and adolescents receive today exceed what children in most other developed nations receive, and what most of us in this room received when we were children.
Another group, he said, would look at vaccines that have not been subject to review in more than 7 years. All of this makes Yale professor Jason Schwartz, who studies vaccine policy, very nervous.
They're already signaling their interest in revisiting long-settled questions around vaccine safety, opening up issues that have been focal points of critics of vaccines for decades.
On the second day, a majority of the panel reaffirmed the CDC recommendations that anyone over 6 months get the annual flu shot. Other votes, however, focused on essentially banning flu vaccines with a mercury-containing preservative called thimerosal. Theories that chemical could cause autism have long been disproven. Even so, manufacturers voluntarily removed it from childhood vaccines years ago. It's rarely used in flu shots anymore. And yet, the panel heard a presentation on alleged safety concerns from the former head of Children's Health Defense, a group that Secretary Kennedy founded. It's questioned vaccine safety and spread misinformation. Dr. Cody Meisner, a pediatrician at Dartmouth, was the only panel member to vote against the recommendations.
I'm not quite sure how to respond to this presentation. This is an old issue that has been addressed.
The meeting of the group, called ACIP for short, was at times chaotic. In fact, the American Academy of Pediatrics decided not to attend. Dr. Jim Campbell, who's with the Academy, says they thought there would be no room for real participation, and the votes on thimerosal prove that.
The vote was based on a single talk without any work group or other expert input. That is not the way that ACIP typically works, so we're just disappointed.
And the meeting has raised big questions about the future of vaccine policy for Dr. Andy Pavia, a pediatrician at the University of Utah.
I think hundreds of physicians, epidemiologists, pediatricians watched with some degree of horror.
Pavia points out this panel helped shape insurance coverage of vaccines, and he worries what they decide going forward could ultimately reduce access to them. Will Stone, NPR News.
We have an interview this morning with Michelle Obama. She talked with our colleague Rachel Martin, former co-host of this program, who now hosts Wildcard. She asks her guests deep questions about their lives, which they choose from a deck of cards. And Michelle Obama was her most recent guest. Hi there, Rachel.
Hi, Steve.
It's so great to see you again. So what did you learn about this super, super famous person?
That she very much wants to be in control of her life in a way that she just wasn't able to be when she was first lady, when she was in the White House. And that means getting to say no to things. I mean, you'll remember she did not go to President Trump's inauguration this year. She did not go to President Jimmy Carter's funeral. She's saying what she wants to say, how she wants to say it, especially on this new podcast she's got with her brother. It's called IMO. Mm-hmm. And part of being able to be herself in this new way is setting the record straight when certain rumors start flying about her marriage, they did.
The fact that people don't see me going out on a date with my husband sparks rumors of the end of our marriage.
So like that is the apocalypse.
It's like, okay, so we don't Instagram every minute of our lives. We are 60. We're 60, y'all.
Okay, so she's doing what she wants to do. I know you asked her a bunch of questions drawing off these cards. Could we hear one of the answers, please?
Yes. Here's her answer to the question she drew from our deck. Has ambition ever led you astray?
Wow. I don't know if my ambition has ever fully been able to actualize itself because of the nature of what me and my husband have done. I mean, you know, I guess you
as
could
argue
as a team,
right?
You know,
It wasn't about your individual ambition.
Was it? Right. It was the team ambition. Mm-hmm. And I went along arguably kicking and screaming, right? Mm-hmm. And as a working mother, I think all of that stuff kind of cut my ambitions short a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I had to make a set of decisions. Okay, my husband's over here. I've got these kids over here. I don't know if I can afford to be ambitious right now.
Right.
So I think I kind of squelched my ambition. But now is a time for me to embrace my own ambition and to define it for me. So maybe the answer is we'll see.
Yeah.
Because I think I'm just now fully stepping into my own ambition.
Yeah. Part of ambition in living your own life is saying yes to things mm-hmm. you want to do. It's also saying no, I mm-hmm. imagine, to things that you don't want to do.
For sure.
Yeah.
And we experienced that. One of the major decisions I made this year to stay put and not attend funerals and inaugurations and all the things that I'm supposed to mm-hmm. attend. That was a part of me, you know, using my ambition to say, let me define what yeah. I want to do apart yeah. from what I'm supposed to do, what the world expects of me. Mm-hmm. And I have to own that. Those are my choices. Whatever the backlash was, I had to sit in it and own it.
Yeah.
But I didn't regret it, you know. But we'll see. Maybe next year we sit down. I go, you know, Rachel, went a little too far.
Our own Rachel Martin speaking with former First Lady Michelle Obama. Rachel, where can people go if they want to hear some more?
Yeah, you can listen to a longer version of that conversation if you search for Wildcard with Rachel Martin in your podcast app, and you can even watch a video of that entire episode on YouTube or Spotify.
Rachel, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
And NPR's Rachel Martin. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by B.J. Lederman. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez.